This week on the show, we sit down for the second part of our interview with Dr. Margaret Power to discuss the role of right-wing women in the overthrow of Salvador Allende's popular unity government in Chile almost 50 years ago. Margaret is a particularly special guest to talk to about this, someone who has personal experience of Chile from the time period, in addition to her academic credentials as a researcher on the topic. If you haven't done so, be sure to check out last week's episode where we talked about a similar theme and another area of Dr. Power's research, which dealt with the New Deal community of Norvelt in Pennsylvania. That's episode 14, and it's just behind this one in your feed. So, without any further ado, here is Dr. Margaret Power on right-wing women in Chile. You moved to San Francisco in 1975 after you graduate from college, and so that's after the Popular Unity government. So, what were your recollections of that period?
I was sort of, by that time, I'd been a Republican, but by that time I was now sort of moving towards the left, and I was in the anti-war movement. And I remember, it shows you how far not to the left I was. I was flying on an airplane. I sort of heard something about socialism, Chile, but I thought, okay. And then I was flying on an airplane to Israel to work on a kibbutz. And I read, I can't remember either Time or Newsweek, talking all about the democratic road to socialism. And mm-hmm. That sounds really great, because I considered myself a kind of socialist. And so I was going to work on a kibbutz, which I thought was a socialist. Okay, socialist. That so was not what I happened there. And then after that, I went to East Berlin just as a tourist the day after the coup. And there was this massive demonstration. So I said, what happened? And these sort of conservative Christian Germans who spoke English explained to me. And then I went to live in southern France, which was, France in the 1970s was very left. And so that's when I really learned more about Latin, about Chile. So I really didn't know that much about the Allende period until 2 to 3 months before it was overthrown. I finished university, went to Chile via much of part of South America, and I lived there from December 1976 to June, end of June 1977.
So in 1976, right, what brings you to the country at that particular moment?
I had first flown to Puerto Rico because I was very active in Puerto Rico solidarity, and I was very active in Chile solidarity. Then I took a ship to Venezuela, then took multiple buses down through Venezuela, Colombia, Ecuador, Peru, and Chile because I had.
That's a long way.
It was a long way. It was the best trip. Yeah, it was a long way. But I had lots of addresses of Chilean political refugees who lived in San Francisco, who had arrived, who had been political prisoners, who arrived following the dictatorship. And so they gave me the addresses of their families. And that was the only reason my sister and I went together. I couldn't have done it alone. That's the only reason that the two of us were able to make contact with anti-dictatorial, pro-Allende Chileans, because we came via their sons. It was sons. And so they trusted us. Okay, so because we had these contacts, we met the cousin of one of the people who said, well, since you're in Chile, and at that point there were very few North Americans, and those who were there were primarily attached to the U.S. Embassy or U.S. companies, and they weren't in the solidarity movement. In fact, I think we were the only people in the solidarity movement that anybody we met had even seen. So that was unique. So anyway, he said to us, since you're here, you should visit the political prisoners. And you should really learn about what the situation is here, since there was perceived to be a news blockade. So one day he and the two of us went to one of the main prisoners that housed political prisoners in Santiago. And we got in because one of the guards, who was more the peasant class, was actually somewhat intimidated by us because we were North American and because we looked upper class. And he said, you can't go in. And Melinda's my sister, said to him, we always go in, as if this was a precedent. And he sort of thought, oh, well, I guess if they've gone in before, then other people have allowed them. I better not break with what's already happened. It's revealing both of his class and his perception of things, but it's also tells you a lot about the strict military hierarchy and order that he was not going to violate what had already happened. So we went in, we met the political prisoners, and then for basically almost the rest of the 6 months we were there, we went to visit them 3 times a week. The political prisoners in Chile, unlike, say, in the United States, were all housed together. So they would have visiting hours at the same time. So at that point, there were probably 50 to 60 of them. They'd come out and they'd all be with their loved ones or family or whoever, most of whom were women, mothers, sisters, girlfriends, wives, daughters, whatever. And I remember 2 events they had for Mother's Day. They had a special event and handed out red carnations to everybody. And then they got up and gave speeches. So in a sense, they took over. They controlled the whole pavilion in a certain way. Then for International Workers' Day, they also handed out the red carnations. They talked about it, and if memory serves me well, we sang the International, which is pretty remarkable to think this was happening during the dictatorship. Yeah. And so I gradually got to know all these people, and because we were there, people trusted us. And then we went to the Vicariate of Solidarity, the Vicaría de la Solidaridad, and through there, we met this socialist sort of very mid-level leader who lived in one of the poor neighborhoods, was working very working class herself, but had been a lifelong socialist. And then she took us under her wing in a certain sense, and we hung out with her a lot, and she introduced us to people in the resistance. So then for some period of time, my sister and I had direct contact with people in the resistance, and I remember we typed communiques that they were going to put out for May 1st that year. I remember that distinctly. But then we stayed with the family members of the different political prisoners. And towards the end, when we were there, things were getting very tense. The dean of the secret police came looking for us. Luckily, we were not there. And we heard about this, so we went to the U.S. Embassy. And at that point, Carter was the president, so there had been a transfer in a lot of the embassy personnel. So there was a very young guy who was there who was, I think, reflecting more Carter's politics of support for human rights, anti-dictatorial. And he basically saw us as these 2 very young, nice, in his mind, foolhardy girls. So I think he probably put out watch out for us, so that when we left, he accompanied us to the airport, made sure we got on the airplane and were not detained, and flew out. And we told him, because we'd gone to Georgetown, we told him that we had been taping people in the Catholic Church. In reality, mm-hmm. we were taping people in the resistance, and so we smuggled these tapes out of Chile. And I was really scared. It was very scary. And it wasn't until the plane took off and we were in the air that I remember, okay, now I can relax.
It was interesting to me that you got like halfway through telling the story and I'm like really interested. You're like, oh, you're going to cut all this, right? I'm like, no, I want yeah. this.
No,
no, it's great.
I think I should write about it, but it's very hard to write about myself. I find it really, really hard.
Sure. Sure.
It's quite remarkable, really.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's a really incredible story. So then let's talk about, not Margaret Power. Let's talk about the 70 years leading up to the election of Allende. Right?
Yeah.
Women increasingly came to occupy, you know, political spaces in Chile, gradually obtaining suffrage, right, as they did in other places in the West. But how was the struggle for women's suffrage received by and associated with the right in Chile?
This, unfortunately, or fortunately, if you like history, I have to go back to the late 1800s. In the late 1800s, the two primary parties were the Conservative Party, which was very allied to the Catholic Church, and the Liberal Party, which was anti-clerical. And this is the same political divisions that existed throughout Latin America. Right. And these were the same two parties that continued up until, in terms of the conservative, the right, up until 1964, or when they transformed and then became the Nationalist Party. And in the late 1800s, the first women to attempt to get the right to vote were conservative women, and they wanted the right to vote in order to defeat the liberals who were anti-clerical and to defend the Catholic Church. And then moving ahead into the beginning of the 20th century, once again, you saw conservative women trying to get the right to vote in order to contribute their vote to upholding the conservative order within Chile. Jumping ahead, since I'm giving the thumbnail sketch here, in the 1930s, the Communist Party started basically in 1919 or 1921 in Chile. And so by the 1930s, there was not an overwhelmingly strong, but let's say a fairly substantially strong Communist Party, and there was also a Socialist Party. And both of those parties had women's affiliations, and they, along with women from another party, the Radical Party, supported the right of women to vote, and they formed different organizations that pushed for women's suffrage. And initially, women were given the right to vote, but just on the municipal level. And the idea, mm-hmm. the concession was, well, it's basically an extension of women's roles within the household, and it's just taking care of the surrounding community. So it's not a recognition of women as full political figures, but it was an acknowledgement that women had their particular gender-based responsibilities that could extend to the larger community. But from the get-go, women in Chile voted separate. Women and men in Chile voted separately, and they always went to separate polling places. In fact, last mm-hmm. year when they had the referendum, or the plebiscite on whether to write a new constitution, was the first time in the entire history of Chile that men and women voted separately, which is quite remarkable. And a lot of people give different arguments as to why that was the case. The one that convinces me is that it was yet another way to express patriarchal control, that women and men could not mingle in public outside the supervision of some male figure. Other people will say, no, it was actually about giving women the right to vote without the influence of a male figure, and therefore right. she would vote more freely. By 1947, all women got the right to vote throughout Chile on both the municipal as well as the national election, and you began to really see the increased, or 1949, I'm sorry, 1949, and you began to see the increased participation of women beginning in the 1950s, which increases with the 1952 election, the 1958 election, and brings us right up to the 1964 election, in which for the first time it was feared that that Allende, the socialist candidate, the candidate from the left coalition, could possibly win the elections. And so it's at that point that both anti-communist organizations among women began to accelerate their activity and work with some women from the Christian Democratic Party, which has been characterized as more of a centrist, reformist party. But it's also the point at which the U.S. government steps in and begins to pump massive amounts of money into targeting women in what in Chile is called the Campaña de Terror, but which I've translated as a scare campaign, because if I said terror campaign, I think because of terrorism's prevalence in the vocabulary and world today, it probably would not be understood to be basically a propaganda campaign. So the campaign, which took place in 1964, the same time as the Johnson Goldwater election in the United States, to me, what's really remarkable about it, this is a per capita expenditure, not ultimate sums of money, but how much per capita. The CIA and the State Department spent more money in Chile per capita than the combined expenses of both the Goldwater and the Johnson campaigns. And they spent it on radio ads, on ads in the newspapers, and on posters that were pasted up on walls all across Chile, and especially radio, because women were much less likely to read newspapers than men were. So they wanted to target women who were in their homes, who typically had the radio on all day as they were working around the house. Mm-hmm.
And Chile is noted usually in the Latin American history classroom for its history of republicanism, mm-hmm. in a landscape of history otherwise dominated by men on horseback. But what was the reality of democracy for the Chilean peasant before the secret ballot was mandated in the mid-20th century?
The reality was that the landowner would gather up the workers, the male workers at this point, on his estate, take them in to vote and say, this is how you vote. Because as you said, there was no secret ballot. So it would not be possible for a peasant to say, oh, sure, some variation of that, I'll vote that way, go into the voting booth and vote a different way. No, it was completely out there who he was voting for. And so then the law was passed against this practice, which opened things up within the countryside, which had been incredibly tightly controlled on so many different levels. So that I mentioned earlier, this Socialist Party woman, she had been a peasant on one of these landed estates. And one of the main reasons she left is because her father, in conjunction with the landowner, had plans for whom she should marry. And mm-hmm. she, because that the extent of the lack of democracy extended even to a woman's inability to choose her marriage partner. So she left, went to the city, and that's how she escaped. And I think part of the democratization had to be with the opening up and making the vote a secret ballot, but it also had to do with people leaving the countryside and moving into the cities where there was more freedom and anonymity at the same time, and with the upsurge of a lot of democratic currents that were traversing Latin America at that point in time, both in the church through the theology of liberation and Vatican II, but also through the growth of unions and the growth of the working class.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell us about the failure of the left and the Popular Unity government to organize women in Chile and pursue and implement policies that would help women?
You bet I can. Okay. Well, the Chilean left was a fairly orthodox Marxist left. And by that I mean that they very much based a lot of their political and theoretical underpinnings on a Marxist and Leninist interpretation of reality. And what that meant in the Chilean context was a focus on the working class, with this increasingly a focus on the peasant class, especially beginning in the 1960s. And the working class that worked in industrial production was overwhelmingly a male working class. And just to cite one figure, in 1970, something like 19 perhaps 20% of women worked outside the home, meaning 80% did not work outside the home. And of that 19 to 20%, the vast majority worked not in factories or industrial production, but as servants, maids in the homes of the middle and the upper class. So they were basically isolated. As far from being part of socialized production in any way, they were isolated within their home or somebody else's home, or women had professional jobs. So the revolutionary figure was basically the male worker. So the tremendous number of policies were geared towards encouraging unionization, encouraging vacation, giving people vacation, health benefits. And a lot of the concept was that women would be the secondary beneficiaries of this. So it was not as if women were invisible exactly, or that women were not taken into consideration. But the idea was, if the male provider earns more money, then you will benefit from it. And while that was sort of largely the thinking on one level, then I think if you look at any picture of any of the leadership of the left political parties, it is men, overwhelmingly men. And there's some women here and there's some women there. Of course there are. But primarily you had men talking to men and men talking to women about what the political realities were. Part of the correlation between the idea that the male's the revolutionary subject was the idea that feminism, which was in the 1970s generating throughout the world, that feminism is a bourgeois capitalist movement in theory that exists only to divide the working class, even though women were not acknowledged as such as members of the working class in their own right, but only as members of the working class through their affiliation with a male worker. Right. Nonetheless, there were women within the Chilean left who really pushed for the liberation of women, for a political examination of women's situation, and for the popular unity to adopt policies and programs that favored women. And there were women's organizations, there were women's federations, there were even some women's marches and activities that took place. So it's not all bleak. It's not as if women were completely absent from the political spectrum. And women were very, very politically engaged on every single level.
So we have women whose political identity is sort of being constructed around not a redefinition of their role as women, but around their, you know, identity as women as constructed in traditional society, right?
In part. But then they're more revolutionary women too.
But in order for us to understand what happens as far as women, sort of where we're going with this story, yeah. Right, is about the condition that women found themselves living in during the popular unity years, yeah. Right? Can you describe how that experience was particularly felt and motivating for yes. women as political subjects after the election of Salvador Allende?
Most women, as I said, 19 to 20% worked outside the home, which means 80% were in the home. And within the home, their gendered identity revolved around, as you mentioned earlier, primarily being homemakers. And so homemakers and mothers, especially. And this whole sense of my role in life is to provide for my family by sewing, by cooking, by taking care of the kids, by cleaning, by washing, etc. So part of the United States government's plan, in conjunction with the Chilean right and the Christian Democrats, was to produce shortages in the Chilean economy. This was a concrete strategy, a plan, as when Nixon and Kissinger basically gave the direction to make the economy scream. What that basically means is make Chilean people suffer. And they did this through a whole series of measures. But how women experienced it was that there were tremendous shortages. So women would describe to me when I interviewed them that these were more the poor working class women, because the upper class women would send their maids to stand in line. So one woman said, for example, for New Year's, one year she wanted to get a chicken for her family. So they stood somewhere between 24 to 36 hours in line just to get a chicken. And she said, a really skinny chicken too. And there was this whole sort of sense of anxiety that there won't be any more toothpaste. There won't be any more toilet paper. It's so weird. You know, when there was the pandemic, everybody started talking about the toilet paper. I thought, wait, why the toilet paper? That's exactly what people were talking about in Chile. Only in Chile, it was real. There wasn't toilet paper. And one of the reasons there wasn't toilet paper, in addition to the blockade that the United States slapped on Chile, is that wealthy producers, both agricultural and industrial, would destroy their products, thus artificially creating shortages. And since they had this long-range vision, okay, maybe this year and maybe next year we won't make much profits, but in the long run we'll get rid of the socialist government and then we will be able to make profits. So I think they were capitalists who thought on a bit longer term, and I tend to think a lot of capitalists think in the current economy we're in right now. So it produces mass anxiety. So women would talk to me over and over again that they heard, oh, such and such store is selling such and such. And they'd say, even if I didn't need it, even if I had never in my life used it, I'd run there, get in line, and try and buy it. It's sort of this mass psychosis that existed. And of course, they said, they didn't say the problem is the CIA that is doing this, or the problem is that wealthy industrials. They say it's the government. The government is corrupt. The government is incompetent. The government doesn't care about us.
I think that the way that recollection of the shortage and more broadly the conditions of the Chilean economy between 1970 to 1973 often feature very centrally in how people on the right to this day will defend the dictatorship. It's interesting that the causes for those economic consequences and the, you know, motives of those economic consequences were carried out by the American state and by capital, you know, in both domestically and internationally. We've kind of, you know, broached it a little bit here already, but so you ended up interviewing right-wing women in Chile in the 90s about their recollections of this movement.
Yes. The antecedents for the movement in the 70s were an organization called Action Women of Chile, and began in 1963. And one of the prime movers and shakers was this woman, Elena Larraín. And Larraín is one of the families in Chile, one of the wealthy families. So then she was profoundly anti-communist. And I have a particular story, I think, about her that I'm going to share that kind of indicates the mindset of some of these wealthy people. She was of European extraction, of Spanish extraction. I doubt she had any indigenous ancestors in her. She lived in a very nice apartment, possibly a condo. So when I first went to visit her, she kept referring to her maid, who was a Mapuche, one of the indigenous women, who at that point was probably at least 50, as La Muchacha, the girl. And she kept talking to me right in front of her about how stupid she was. And if she breaks one more thing, she's going to take it out of her paycheck. And the woman was completely impassive. She needed the job, obviously. And she had Elena Larraín had absolutely no compunction, no hesitation to talk about this woman in front of me. Her assumption was that I would share her racist attitudes towards these people. So and I'm sure everybody in her class, she felt totally comfortable saying it with them. And then the second time I went to visit her, she gave me huge boxes of materials because she had very carefully she and her husband had very carefully cut out every single newspaper article that dealt with the women against Allende. And she said, the maid will carry these down for you. And so we went out to the elevator, and there were two elevators, and I stepped into the elevator with the maid, and she said, oh, no, no, no. You go in that elevator to the right. She goes in that one to the left. You should not ride in the same elevator together. So there was this incredible distinction between them. And Elena Larraín was one of the women who had started the organization in 1963, the anti-communist women's organization that helped with the terror campaign, but she was also one of the main women who started the feminine power, Poder Femenino, against Allende, along with another woman I interviewed, Maria Correa Morande, also who had been under Pinochet, the ambassador to Mexico, and wrote a book which she gave to me and my friend Lisa Valdez, who I did a lot of these interviews with, and about the indigenous culture in Mexico. It is so bad. It is unbelievable. All about these savages who sacrifice the victims to the gods. Oh my God. Anyway, so these were women from the extreme right. But they worked with women in the right-wing party, the Nationalist Party, which formed from the convergence of the Conservative Party and the Liberal Party. And they also worked with Christian Democratic women and I can't remember if it's an independent. So all these women joined together, and their main goal was to get rid of Allende, encourage the military to to overthrow him, and to encourage other women to participate. And their main way of doing it was to project themselves as apolitical women who just simply could not function in the kind of Chile that the Popular Unity government had brought. And they were so moved by it that while they never for a moment would renounce their gendered role as wives and mothers, were willing to go into the streets to save their families. That was sort of the myth that they created among themselves and continually projected.
So one of the things that we talked about in the first part of our interview is, this idea of a top-down understanding of history or a bottom-up understanding of history, and particularly related to people's politics, right? And I think that, in this situation, we have, the United States government and international and domestic capital creating arbitrary shortages in the Chilean economy. We have upper and middle class Chilean women who are organizing middle and lower class Chilean women to get out in the street in opposition to Popular Unity. Is this a top-down manipulation of middle and lower class women, or do we have a bottom-up analysis here?
It goes against the grain of what I believe in many ways, but I have to say I think this was a top-down situation, which doesn't mean the poor and working class women were nothing more than puppets. But it does indicate that the U.S. government, in conjunction with the heads of political parties in Chile, and some of the heads of the political parties in Chile were also part of this women's organization, they did have a very clear, conscious strategy about how to organize women. And much as we may not like to think it, because I think there is this whole tendency to, in my point of view, exaggerate the amount of agency that individuals have. Sometimes people don't have that kind of agency that we think they do, or that academics like to pretend they have. Sometimes people are manipulated. I mean, how do we understand the fact that people in this country will not take the vaccine when they are basically risking their lives and the lives of other people to reject it? That is not a bottom. It appears to be a bottom-up movement. It's become a bit of a mass movement, but that to me is manipulation from the top.
Well, and I think it's interesting for you to kind of unite those two stories, because I think for me to push back at either of them would only be to point out that what we have in both of those cases is sort of an intergenerational failure on behalf of the left to organize its natural audience, right? In particular, we're thinking of, you know, the historical failure of the left, in particular, of course, the Marxist left, to include women or people of color in their coalitions of the past, right? And I think that, you know, in the United States, right, they're the less educated, right, the and low income, you know, folks have been, you know, kind of abandoned by politicians and policymakers in the United States, you know, in similar ways. And so I think that your research here sort of raises interesting questions about, you know, this question of top down versus bottom up, but also of these historical failures of the left, you know, that seem to only be repeated, right? And that we seem to sort of struggle to come up with clear answers to them, you know, even today. You know, to what extent should coalitions, you know, focus on, you know, questions of race or gender, right, or issues of class, primarily, and we still live with these controversies and challenges today. But one thing I wanted to bring up, and just sort of before I hand it over to you to kind of describe to me these recollections that you collected, you know, is the experience I had with my boss,
right,
in, uh-huh, when we were there working. So I was
working, and where were you?
So, right. So I was working as an English teacher in Rengo, just south of Rancagua, and
about an hour and a half hours south of Santiago.
Right. It's in the O'Higgins region, which is just south of the Metropolitana, and so just a couple hours south of where people have probably been if they've been to Chile, and I remember at the time, it's early on, right, as we basically just got there, and my Spanish is not you know, where it needs to be able to like talk about my research with people. Right. And so I'm meeting the principal, right. And mostly sort of having it translated through a colleague of mine, because the principal did not speak English. Right. And my, you know, and I didn't really speak Spanish. And this was actually the first time. And this is what I realized was kind of the issue. This was the first time I had encountered someone who was explicitly in favor of the dictatorship, mm-hmm, of Augusto Pinochet, mm-hmm, right? And suspicious of me as someone who might not, and this person is about to be my boss for the next 12 months, right? And so, I felt a genuine fear. Right. And I think it's a fear grounded in my like general shelter, you know, status as who I am. But I remember like being quite scared of this woman who was the principal. And she began to describe to me, and I was even able to take in with my limited Spanish, her reasons. Mm-hmm. You know, which she was very willing to give me.
Oh yeah.
For why we just had to do it, right? Because our grandchildren would have been in debt, right? Because you know, because they would have, you know, the communists would have given the country over to the Soviets, et cetera, et cetera. And I mean, I was at the time just, you know, just mostly like a deer in the headlights at the moment, not really knowing how to react to that combination of social obligations. But but when I was reading your accounts of your interviews with these women who are, you know, remembering their role in the overthrow of the Allende government, you know, and you know, their eagerness to recount their experiences, right, and their tendency to sort of focus on relatively predictable pieces of their experience and recollection and shared memory of popular unity, really was striking to me in reading your account of it. So would you tell us a little bit about the types of things that are set and remembered?
It's so true. The reason they weren't suspicious of me as opposed to you is because they were thrilled. They thought somebody was finally coming to hear their side of things. Now, it could be because I was a grad student and there was nothing. I automatically tamped down any opinion I had whatsoever, so that I presented myself as someone who said, which is quite honest, because when you do oral history, you cannot lie. It's sort of unethical to lie to people. So what I said was, I am just amazed at what you were able to accomplish. I don't think history has given you your due. I really want to learn about you. And they loved it. And so some of the stories they told me were quite shocking. This one woman, for example, and she was a lower middle class woman who adored Pinochet and basically said the only problem with Pinochet is that he was not like this other general, General Ibáñez. And what General Ibáñez had done is he rounded up all the homosexuals and he dumped them in the ocean. So now nobody could find their bodies. But unfortunately, right. What Pinochet, mi general, my general, what he did is he put them in mass graves. And now people are finding the mass graves as if that was the problem. He had a little, oops, boo-boo.
Wow.
And I was sort of like you. I thought, what do I say to this? Right. And so it's really, I didn't know what to say because my concern was if I say what I think to one of them, then they will pass the word on to other women I want to interview, and next,
right,
I will not get any more interviews. So instead, what I just said, so I literally said, I remember it so well, I said, oh, gee, that wasn't a very nice way to treat those homosexuals, which had said nothing about Pinochet, nothing, but it was all about this general who was long gone, and, you know, wow, sort of like, oh, it's just not being very nice. And then this other woman, actually the friend of, the mother of one of my really good friends, which is how I got to interview her, talked a lot about how, thank heavens, Pinochet came, because we would have had a civil war. And if we would have had a civil war, thousands and thousands and thousands of Chileans would have died and they would have killed each other. Then she goes, look at what's happening in Central America. That's what would have happened here. Pinochet spared us from the kind of civil wars they're having in Central America. I mean, you can see there's sort of a certain internal logic to that position. Not that I would agree with it, but I can see what she says. And that would just be the kind of thing. The only women, actually, there were only two women who had all indicated that they'd change. One of them was a woman who had worked, a working class woman who had worked in a factory, and she would talk about the owner of the factory was completely against Allende. He would pay his workers to go demonstrate against Allende, pay their fare. They would dump the shoes that they produced out the back so that they couldn't have shoes. Then what happened after the dictatorship, her son was part of the left, and he got arrested. Her beloved, adored son was arrested tortured by the military, went into exile. And at that point, she completely flipped and became not only against the dictatorship, but actually went on international speaking tours after the dictatorship to talk about him, to talk about what the dictatorship was like. And the only other women, and this was somewhat representative, was a Christian Democratic Party woman. And she started to change her position against Pinochet when she realized that what was happening was not what she had hoped and expected, which the Christian Democratic Party fully expected that after the military overthrew Allende, that Eduardo Frei would become president. Right. Well, she did not anticipate the massive abuse of human rights, murder, torture. I think she was quite sincere. And I think she defined herself as a Catholic woman who was fairly horrified at what she saw. But a lot of the impetus, or sort of the turning point, was when the Christian Democratic Party, let down by the fact that their esteemed leader was not the president, moved into the opposition.
I think it's one of the things that I think is worth saying in defense of the Chileans in general is that a lot of the things that seem apparent now are apparent to us only in retrospect, right? Yeah. We're able to know what Nixon told Kissinger in October of 73, and we're able to know that they were destroying foodstuffs and rather than let them reach market and things like that. And so I think that's worth remembering here. And it's especially worth remembering because in your research, as you're pointing out here, lots of people began to, change their opinions and their remembrances of it when presented with this information after the dictatorship.
But I also want to point out that there's a way that I think where people were consciously oblivious and making themselves oblivious to what was happening, because so many families in Chile had at least one, if not more, member, because family, the extensive family is some of the social base of Chilean life.
And it's a small country as well. I think that's something that it's hard for Americans to appreciate.
1 million people. And when many of them are concentrated in Santiago, then you go to smaller towns where literally everybody kind of knows each other. It was, and so I can't imagine there was a family in which some member was not imprisoned, exiled, tortured, murdered, something disappeared, something happened to them. But I remember distinctly, I met two North Americans who were there working in the Peace Corps at the exact same time I was. And their vision of Chile was, they had no clue what was going on. They did not see it at all. They lived in the wealthy neighborhoods. They hung out, went to the U.S. Embassy. They never ventured into poor neighborhoods. Oh, those places are dangerous. And they hung out with Chilean government officials. So I'm not quite sure what they did as Peace Corps people. I thought, who exactly were you hanging out with? I mean, Peace Corps supposedly hangs out with poor people, but I think they were maybe teachers in some middle or upper class school. It was very odd, but I thought you lived in a Chile that I did not live in, and you were completely blind to what was going on. Well, on a very optimistic note, things have really changed in Chile. I mean, Chile now is making it that the new constitution is promoting the participation and rights of women. Women are basically incredibly not only integrated, but leading a lot of the political movements, the left and progressive political movements in Chile. There's a huge movement to support abortion rights, unlike some places in the United States just now. And there's a lot of support for LGBT issues and people as well. So I think things have really changed in Chile. So that's the really good news. So I feel very positive about what's happening in Chile now. So because things were so bad doesn't mean things will stay that bad. And just because things aren't necessarily great here in terms of, say, abortion and stuff like that, doesn't mean we give up and don't keep fighting.
Yeah, and I think the through line here is that when you offer the Chilean people, you know, the chance to use their democracy, you know, and to inform themselves and to use their democracy, you know, whether that's as a result of the secret ballot being mandated or just, you know, burning the subway down to force a constitutional convention, right? That the Chileans take a very, you know, sort of active role when they're not being literally held down by the military arm of a modern state. And I think that's what sort of what I take away from what's happened there more recently, right?
I totally agree. Yeah.
Well, Margaret, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show and talking to us about people whose politics confound us. And I think that having the experience of being able to read both of those things together, you know, the Norvelt Westmoreland County stuff against your research on right-wing women in Chile was really interesting, and the connections between them are very apparent, and I think they will be to anyone who takes the time to listen to these two episodes.
Well, I want to thank you because it's really great to talk with, or I guess be interviewed by, someone who knows so much about Chile and the topic and the subject. And actually, I think by talking to you both the last week and this week, I think I've come to see the connections perhaps even a little more clearly than I had. So thank you.
Well, that's great. That's great. And I'm glad we were able to create this together.
Nearly all the people arrested by a particular Beverly Hills police task force over the past year were Black individuals. And this was alleged in a new lawsuit about racial profiling in the wealthy California city. So it shouldn't come as a surprise, but I mean, it's one of those things where it is shocking and it isn't shocking at the same time.
And I mean, surely there aren't more than 106 Black people in Beverly Hills. That seems like they must have just arrested all of them. It's less than 2% Black Beverly Hills is. So like the 106 Black people, not an insignificant part of that 2% of the population in Beverly Hills. I can see a future where, you know, this is basically every, you know, high-end neighborhood, and the police force is privatized. When you listen to, you know, the crypto guys talk about their citadel, like I think it's going to be,
it's going to
be more of this special task force is designed to keep the unwashed masses away from the gates. So this past week, the Biden administration allowed 8.9 million people to lose all federal unemployment benefits, at least those associated with COVID and the COVID recovery. You know, it's been interesting to, you know, listen to the assurances that the economy doesn't need any more of this kind of support. Of course, most of that is because the Biden administration is sure that the economy is moving at a decent enough pace and that hiring this fall is going to pick up enough to continue having economic growth and giving folks you know, a chance to go back to work. But of course, the individuals who are being, you know, bumped off of a needed benefit just this last week, you know, in this past week, are going to go through a significant hardship.
I was just going to say the number is misleading. I mean, here, you know, like I linked like an ABC News article. 8.9 million people will lose all federal unemployment benefits today as, you know, the COVID safety net ends. And then earlier in the day, I had seen someone else saying 35 million people are set to lose unemployment benefits on Labor Day. And it was actually a link to Truthout. This is Matt Brunig of the People's Policy Project. So noted Thursday, the Labor Department's latest weekly unemployment insurance report shows that, quote, 9.2 million people are currently receiving benefits from either the Pandemic Emergency Unemployment Compensation Program or the Pandemic Unemployment Assistance Program, which were implemented last year to extend the duration of jobless aid and provide assistance to those who are typically ineligible for UI, such as gig workers. Right below it, according to the Census Household Pulse Survey, the average household that is receiving UI benefits has 3.8 members in it, Brunig observed. This means that around 35 million people, 10% of the U.S. population, live in households that are scheduled to lose unemployment income. So, like,
well, I think that a lot of the plan for ending these benefits, you know, has been based on an assumption that the economy is beginning to improve. Of course, we saw
and
the
that everyone's
jobs
just going to go back to work.
Yeah, well, and we saw the jobs report.
Don't go back to work. Don't worry about it.
Right, and we saw that hiring has slowed down. You know, over the last month, you know, there's only a little more than a quarter of a million jobs added.
Build
to the
back
economy.
Better, Michael. Build back well, better.
Right, and I think that what all of this really emphasizes, and it's a bit trite to even point it out at this point, but the subtext of pandemic assistance as a discouraging force, you know, that's keeping laborers from joining in the labor market, reveals that the combustible elements in the engine of post-industrial capitalism are the threat of starvation and exposure.
Yeah.
And nothing else, right? It would be one thing if that was a threat being imposed by nature, as it has been in antiquity and historically.
Yeah.
But these are conditions that are sustained only by an artificial scarcity that exists to ensure high rent prices and profits for property owners, right? And so this notion or this language about how these benefits have discouraged laborers from having to go work in the context of, you know, a SARS pandemic, that this discouraging force, right, has been the things that's been keeping these people, you know, from being exposed to the vectors of contagion and starvation and exposure. And I think that the callousness of talking about these folks being discouraged by, you know, having all of this free money thrown their way really reveals the, you know, the depravity that is at the heart of this society when it's functioning normally, as we refer to it, right? That the normalcy, right, it exists only with the passive and sometimes active threat to put you and your family and children on the fucking street. And if they can't, and the economy does not work, you know, for the people it's supposed to work for, when that threat is not being applied evenly to the population, right? It doesn't, and that's not to say that it doesn't work for the vast majority of the ultra wealthy who could care less whether real human beings are doing labor or not. But for rent seekers and for the capitalists who own the service sector, their entire bottom line, you know, exists because people are subject to starvation and exposure. And without that passive threat, right, those people don't line their pockets fast enough for the economy to be seen as, you know, meeting its expectation. You know, and so that's what the Biden administration is doing. And that's what Democrats and liberals who are letting these things lapse, like the eviction moratorium, like the unemployment benefits, is they're reintroducing the human misery that is necessary for people to make so much money that, you know, they and their descendants never have to work again. Mm-hmm. Right. That has to be protected and maintained, rather than discouraging laborers from working during a SARS pandemic.
So I think something obviously we have to address is Texas effectively outlawing abortion. We've been seeing articles saying, is it time to pack the court? And, you know, that's sort of the proposal of, for example, Joe Biden adding, you know, two more Supreme Court justices to the court. Like, for me, there's not much to say besides the fact that, like, yeah, go ahead and do it.
Yeah, I mean, I think for about 80 years, in any other political system,
mm-hmm.
except for ours, that would have been something that occurred. It would have happened during the Great Depression.
Yeah.
The same way, you know, most powers of the executive were expanded during that time. And I think that that's kind of one thing. That said, as much as, you know, I think in our dream Democratic Party, that was, you know, as sanguine and as serious as we think it should be, would pack the court. Of course, that's assuming, you know, a best case scenario. And I think that what we have is far, far worse than just a Democratic Party that won't pack the court, right? We have a Democratic Party that won't even do what it must do when it holds power to ensure that conservatives don't get to appoint Ruth Bader Ginsburg's replacement, right? Mm-hmm. And it is the failure of the Obama administration and the Democrats and Ruth Bader Ginsburg to step down while the Democrats held the House and the Senate and the White House between 2008 and 2010. The expectation that Republicans will take power again is not just like an element kind of built into our political system. It's in fact a critical part of how Democrats limit the horizons of possible change. So Democrats, when they're planning policy, will constrain, you know, in order to make the donor class happy, they will constrain the horizons of possible change by using the, you know, sanguinity of the Republican Party, you know, to kind of keep the left in line. Okay. So Democrats understand very, very well how the pendulum swings, which means that not replacing geriatric justices on the Supreme Court when you control all of the federal government is a choice. And it's a choice which betrays that the fate of the court doesn't mean anything to these people. Yeah. It doesn't mean more than the narcissism of Ruth Bader Ginsburg or Barack Obama. It doesn't even, you know, and it doesn't even really rise on the list of, you know, what liberals care about ultimately, right? Because it's not even like, you know, because Democrats like to kind of try to use the court as a cudgel, right? Mm-hmm. To get people into the voting booth, but liberals aren't even motivated by the shit, right? And, you know, and
not at all.
And so liberals aren't motivated to vote for the court. And when Democrats are in power, they leave geriatric people in there to be replaced by Republican presidents. And if it really mattered, the way we're told it matters when elections come around, if the Supreme Court mattered that much, the Democrats would have blackmailed Ruth Bader Ginsburg off the court if she wouldn't step down. If it really mattered.
Yeah.
If women's abortion rights are important, then Ruth Bader Ginsburg comes off the court by hook or by crook. She comes off the court. And so does every other justice on, you know, who might stand a chance of kicking it
under a Republican presidency. Yeah. Because if that's not how you conduct yourself, then we're just doing national ritual. There are no stakes, and none of the people who purport to care about this stuff actually care.
I'm just not really a fan of people that old being in any kind of public office like that. You know?
Yeah.
I'm gonna be ageist here. I don't think someone who's you know nearly 90 years old should be sitting on the Supreme Court or be president or be in, you know, the United States Senate or the House of Representatives.
Well, no. If people of that age, if they really care about the things that they say they care about, they shouldn't want to be there either.
Yeah.
But the thing is that this is the problem, is that ultimately our political system is just national ritual carried out by the bourgeoisie. Ultimately, the Supreme Court as an institution and its fidelity and respectability under the founding and the framing is more important to Barack Obama and RBG than women's abortion rights.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and so we're now watching like the class of people who I don't know, lined the pockets of RBG's grandchildren by buying backpacks and t-shirts with her likeness on them. Right. We're watching like those people weep for abortion rights in Texas when, you know, St. Ruth fucking blew it. Fucking died on the court instead of stepping down in 2008. This is my favorite thing, is that, you know, the most pushback that you'll get to that is literally just, oh, well, how are they supposed to know that the Republicans are going to take power again in the American system? Get the fuck out. That's bullshit.
Yeah.
It's absolute bullshit. The Republicans taking power again is literally essential for the Democrats' project. Mm-hmm. Because if the Republicans were never going to take power again, the Democrats would actually be expected to wield power and propose a vision of the future.
Yeah. Right?
Which is not the objective of the Democratic Party.
So I think the other thing that is important to take away from this, and not necessarily related to reproductive rights, partially related, I guess, is what I'm about to get at here, is that Texas basically found a loophole in how to bypass this, you know, and here's precedent for other states to do the same thing. But I mean, can it also be said that here is a blueprint for, you know, right-wing legislatures to circumvent other kinds of laws that we have, whether that's, you know, gun laws or, you know, like, do we see a situation where states get more involved, you know, in circumventing domestic surveillance or something like that? You know,
this sort of basic argument that the states have the authority to ignore what the federal government says. You know, that's been the basic argument of the right in this country since the founding, right? I mean, that's,
they did
that
it.
Is the
Texas fucking pants them. Yeah. They did it.
Right. But this, right. But in the case of like this particular ruling, what could actually change, could change all of this would just be a federal law, right? Mm-hmm. But because we don't have real political institutions in this country, you should just cackle at the idea of Congress doing anything here, right? And I think that really, if the last 20 years of my life have had one theme, it's that there are no political solutions in the United States. And if you need a political solution to make anything happen, it's not going to happen.
Yeah,
because we just don't really have political systems here, and to the extent that we have them, they're just national ritual from the 18th century, and I think that's the real, you know, the fact that we've been talking about Roe v. Wade for 50 years
all just archaic forms that are cracking and crumbling.
Right. That if there were real politics in this country, would have been wiped away long ago. But because there's so much consensus among the elite in the United States, there is never really an issue with the fact that the state can't resolve a political disagreement.
Well, we're all just so comfortable with relying on institutions and laws and all that were put forth in a time period so radically different from our own, and we're just expected to just continue with these same things that like people in like the early 19th century were living in. I'm like, how does that make any sense? Why does that apply? Right. But why does that at all apply to someone who's living in the year 2040 or something like that? You know, it doesn't.
Why would you respect those institutions to the detriment of people living in reality? Because that's really what we say when we say, no, our Supreme Court justice can die on the court, right? No, it's more important to maintain the apolitical integrity of the court than it is to pack it, right? What this tells us is that what's more important than people, what's more important than politics or even democratic will even is the maintenance of the prestige of these institutions, right? because it's a ritual, because it's a cult, and because there's not really another function for these things to perform, because everyone understands that there aren't political solutions, right? You know, I mean, to the extent that anything can be done by the legislature, it's just sign in checks, right? And how they sign checks and where that money's going within a constrained, set of limitations. But as far as like saying how society should be run or anything like that, it's not a prayer, not even a prayer.
We can just kind of briefly cover this.
Yeah, I was looking
at our lovely friend Bolsonaro in Brazil, who not too long ago was bound to a hospital bed for what, bowel obstruction?
Yeah, he had a bowel obstruction that required them to remove like, I don't know, like 20 pounds of shit out of his mouth through a tube, which, it seems like a fitting thing for somebody who's been like encouraging the Brazilian people to like just spit directly into each other's mouths for sport ever since the pandemic started.
Yeah, and that's also coming from a man who dealt with severe COVID, just like Donald Trump and just like Boris Johnson. So had the treatments, and we've covered this before, but had those treatments they were given not existed, all three of them would have fucking croaked.
This past week, an open letter in Brazil claimed at rallies that Bolsonaro followers represent a danger to democracy and might mount an insurrection modeled off of what Trump supporters did at the U.S. Capitol on the 6th of January.
Oh, good.
Right. The signatories include former Spanish PM José Luis Zapatero, as well as several other European and Latin American observers from other countries. Bolsonaro on August 10th directed, this is quoting now from the report or from the letter, quote, directed an unprecedented military parade through the capital city of Brasilia as his allies in Congress push sweeping reforms to the country's electoral system that he says are critical before the presidential elections next year. And I think it may be worth backing up a little bit. So in the 20th century, Brazil had a relatively popular military dictatorship, one that was very well supported on the right and which is still deeply missed by people, in Bolsonaro's stable, right?
Yeah.
And, so Bolsonaro and his rhetoric about military and dictatorship and all of that certainly has always encouraged that type of political action, right? There, it's not the glorification of the Brazilian military and its dictatorship is basically the central piece of the ideology of the Brazilian right, is that, in fact, the only problems with it was that it didn't go far enough, right? That it that it didn't just kill off all these pesky leftists who are still, running around Brazil today. Yeah. And so I think that, like, you know, with Brazil, it is, you know, I think that Bolsonaro is probably, you know, the most likely person to pull down, you know, one of the states of the major economies of the world right now, you know, then, you know, I think that, and so that's what is the source of this letter, that has been put out by, as we said, this range of,
a lot of people.
Yeah. A full range of 150 people. Yeah. Observers. Yep. Including Nobel laureates, human rights activists, and of course, presidents from other countries. I don't suspect that that would make too much of a difference if the Brazilian government and its military truly decided to crack down.
So something I really, really wanted to touch on for this episode is this article I saw on Reddit.
I saw this, yeah.
Yeah. I shouldn't laugh, but man, like, this is in the New York Daily News, is where I got this from. Two Rikers units go more than 24 hours without guards. 2 Milli says, as New York City Oversight Board raises alarm on jail suicide. So, the lead here, a staff shortage at Rikers Island left two jail units without correction officers for more than 24 hours on Tuesday and Wednesday, a prisoner reported. And the city oversight board said the ongoing personnel problems factored in a wave of suicides in the jail since December. So two Rikers units known as 3 West and 3 North in the Otis Bantam Correctional Center were without correction officers through at least noon Wednesday, leaving inmates in the strange position of helping other inmates to get to court transport and video conferences, said Terrence Ferguson, the hip-hop artist known as 2 Milli. And he said, "We are really running the dorm by ourselves. I've never seen anything like this," said Ferguson, who was serving a sentence for gun possession. Ferguson said Wednesday afternoon that there had been no officer on his floor since 6 a.m. Tuesday. "I've been answering the phones."
Well, and there's all these anti-vax, like, corrections officers and all this sort of stuff. And, you know, and this has been a problem in more places than just at Rikers, you know, not just, you know, COVID outbreaks, but just lacking the workforce to staff our world's largest, you know, prison population. And I think that, yeah, I think you're exactly right that this is just like, just collapse, just a collapse symptom. And I don't know how else you read that. You know, that said, I, you know,
truth is stranger than fiction. I mean, you can't make that up, man.
Prisoners are answering the phones at Rikers. Well, and, you know, all power to him. I would love, you know, I'm somebody who would support, you know, the unionization and capture of prisons by, you know, incarcerated peoples. And so, all power to them. And I hope they don't let the corrections officers back in.
This is an independently produced podcast. You can follow us on Twitter at COINTELPROPOD and support more of our work on our Patreon page. The link is in the show notes and in our Twitter bio. We'll see you next week on COINTELPRO.